Morning.
Morning, Your Honor. Francis Fazzulli for Plaintiff Mr. Idima. Thank you for the opportunity to address the Court today and hopefully to elucidate some of these issues that appear to be in need of clarity or resolution of conflict. I'm also honored to be joined in this inquiry with the veritable Dean of the Cockbright Bar.
Can you speak a little louder?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to briefly set a little bit of context for where we are at. We are trying to apply the rules set forth in Apple Computer and in Three Boys Music on substantial similarity and inverse ratio rule, and also taking a searching inquiry towards some of the plain meaning of the statute regarding derivative works in a context, and pardon me, Your Honor, if I cite to a case that it's not mentioned in the briefs, but the recent Supreme Court case of Eldred, in which affirmed the extension of the copyright amendments for the elongation of the limited term of protection for authors. And in it, the Court reaffirmed the strong philosophy of protection in an age, in a post-industrial age, in which America is in large part a supplier of software, of entertainment, of artistic goods around the world. And I think that is important to put that in context. And a little bit of irony here as well, that the opponent in this case, DreamWorks, was then founded on the proposition of being writer-friendly and based on the idea that high concepts have considerable value in the entertainment world. And I think that one of the issues we can address, we can look directly to what DreamWorks says in its film. And it says, based on a story by Leslie Cockburn and Andrew Cockburn, it also says at the end of the credits that there is no allusion or reference to any historical figure in terms of character or event. This is not a nonfiction story. Now, I'd like to address first, Your Honor, the issue of preemption of the implied contract issue, because I think that this is the first case for the Ninth Circuit to squarely address this issue. We think that the evidence for what the Congress intended does not support what DreamWorks is saying. Disney versus Wilder was a very strong part of the entertainment law aspect of this country, borrowed in other states, and certainly a strong point of view for a half a century in the state of California, the entertainment capital. There's nothing in legislative history that indicated that Disney versus Wilder was intended to be overruled. Indeed, we have a situation, a case, the Scrabble case, in which you had the situation in which there's not enough copying or protectable expression to constitute copyright infringement, but yet the Court did find that there is a breach of implied contract within that framework. And I think that that is one issue that the circuit should follow the lead of the other circuits and finding that in the Wrench case, for example, that we do not have any sort of preemption with respect to an exclusive remedy because you have an extra element. You have a contractual relationship, kind of relationship that was identified in the by Justice Traynor in the Columbia case and also reiterated in the Disney versus Wilder case.
I was going to ask you a question about the letter that was not accepted by the district court because the district court denied the motion to amend. Let's say this case ended tomorrow. Would the statute of limitations have run for you to file a fresh action based on that letter?
I would say not, Your Honor. I think that it would be part of the nucleus of facts that pertain to the original filed action. I don't believe we should have to file a new action.
That's not my question. My question is, if you had to, would the time have run?
No, Your Honor. In terms of the...
So I would ask, I suppose, your opponents to address the question why they're fighting so hard, because if you can, you can raise it here or you could raise it separately. I guess I don't see what the gain is on their part then.
Well, with respect to the letter as a copyright issue, I don't understand you either, Your Honor, because as a matter of res judicata, it cannot be applied, because their whole theory is that if it's not properly before the district court, the registration certificate for that letter, then by definition, it's not a claim which could have been brought at that time. Therefore, it's not res judicata. We're not precluded from filing another action.
And as, whether they're right or wrong, as a matter of judicial estoppel, they wouldn't be able to raise res judicata in a second action based on a letter.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
So, but it does get us involved a little bit in the merits of that in terms of procedurally how should we go about doing it. And one way we can address it is by whether the denial for the request for leave to amend was an abuse of discretion. And I think under these circumstances, where there's been no prejudice because there is no discovery that was done, and therefore the most important issue, I think, is their argument that it was futile to address the letter. And I don't see, in light of the chart...
Well, with respect to the items that are in the record, excluding the letter, what, in your view, are the most important elements that create a factual issue for a jury with respect to substantial similarity? We know it can't just be general plot ideas. We know it can't just be general character ideas. What are the specific developed elements, fictional elements, that you think would allow a finding of substantial similarity?
Well, first of all, the basic plot premise of smuggling a nuclear backpack weapon in a diplomatic pouch through to New York to go to the UN to atone in a distorted terrorist mine.
Now, was the UN in, I forget now if it was in the
It was in
novel.
Mr. Morris's treatment.
Okay, it was in the treatment. Okay. Go ahead.
And with respect to that, then there are various characters which were referenced in Red Bull Rising. The colonel, the friendly colonel, the dynamic between the lead character, the irreverent, brash, green beret, and as well as the daughter of the colonel, which was referenced and also in the movie in the hearing with respect to sending the Jeep, the vehicle over. There are a number of elements, and we can trace them by the chart by referencing the page references in the excerpts of record, which do not correspond to the letter citations, and they are numerous. What you don't have, and their point is, I take it, that you don't have it in a linear sequence placed as well as in the letter.
I think their position also is that the elements, at least taken singly, are generic, that you can't copyright a rash green beret, for example, that other people can have that character without filing a copyright.
Well, here is the error in their filtration analysis. And this relates, I think, also to an observation made in the Apple computer case. When you talk about sens affaire, you have to have an evidentiary basis for it. You have to have something in the record, we believe, that says this is the prior art, so to speak, to use an analogy from the patent law field. This is the prior novel. This is the prior treatment. This is Rambo or it's not Rambo. And give the opportunity to the plaintiffs to draw a distinction. The plaintiffs did have expert testimony regarding whether there was an adequate precedent in the literature of novels and literature of films. They had Mr. Moore. They had a film critic. And they went through this. The other side presented nothing. So there's no opportunity to cross-examine that. And Apple Computer, what Microsoft did is they had a video describing what the competitors did out there in the terms of sequencing their Windows and filing their Windows. There's evidence in the record in Apple Computer.
Well, that went to a slightly different point in Apple Computer. I mean, the thing here is if you start with a generic idea or you start with some historical facts and you put a little gloss on them, is the gloss something that just naturally follows from the idea such that it's not protectable?
Okay. And then there would have to be something to inform that judgment, Your Honor.
Well, yes, by reading all of the submissions, by looking at the allegedly infringing work, by looking at the identified list of similarities, extracting from it what's protectable, filtering out what's unprotectable.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And seeing what's left. And when you do all that, as the district court did, fairly painstaking way, one is left with the abiding conclusion that the works is are just totally dissimilar.
Well, Your Honor, we have to interpret the meaning of the statute based upon. That's the litmus test for determining whether a work is a derivative work. Whether they have permission.
Well, now, the derivative work thing comes up in the reply brief for the first time. So it seems to me what we're looking at is just in an ordinary copyright infringement sense, whether the eight submissions, excluding the 1994 letter, are substantially similar to Peacemaker in the protectable elements.
All right. What I would address on that aspect, Your Honor, is that in order to determine, as the district court mainly relied upon two principles, and they were affirmative defenses, they were historical fact, merger, and sens affaire. Mm-hmm. They had the duty to present evidence in support of that affirmative defense. They didn't provide any evidence.
I'm sorry, Mr. Pacelli, since I'm the culprit, obviously, I don't understand exactly what they failed to do that Apple says that they should have done.
Well, the sens affaire, as we mentioned, Apple Computer said that there is reference, sometimes needs for expert testimony.
Yeah.
They made a reference to the video played by Microsoft there to help explain sens affaire. The Jackson case referred to.
But you have everything here in front of you. I mean, you don't have a licensing issue here like you had in Microsoft about the derivation of the graphical user interface. I mean, I don't understand what more the defendants would have done other than put on Peacemaker and say, okay, look at it and read the submissions and look at your comparison tape, all of which I've done, all of which we've all done. And so what I'm looking to you to do is to explain where it is specifically that there are protectable elements that create a triable issue of substantial similarity.
Your Honor, with respect to, let's just take, for example, the first aspect, which is the retribution for an attack by UN or NATO and against the Muslim, and the retribution in terms of smuggling a nuclear backpack weapon obtained from a crumbling Soviet Union empire, and to bomb the UN, and to be saved through the efforts of a rogue character, Green Beret. You go through the list of all those items, and there's nothing in the literature that they evidenced in the record below which said any of those plot sequence points were manifest anyplace else. And here's what the problem we have in not having discovery go forward on this issue to basically test sens affaire. We know from what's in the record that the film itself says that it was based upon an article by the Cockburns.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the statutory language you're focusing on, derivative works, and the infringement of derivative work is based upon. We have, in essence, an admission that the DreamWorks knows how to calibrate what is based upon for giving credit. Now, if we examine what the district court summarized that article an article that appeared well after the fact, you know that that could not possibly have been the source of it. There was a page and a half treatment, which the district court summarized, which did come 3 months after the Idema Spielberg letter. And if you look at those elements, they are just a portion of the elements that are on the chart. But yet it was sufficient enough for them to put a credit on the film to say it was based upon. And I think this is an area in which, Your Honor, actions speak louder than words, so to speak. If, for example, one-fifth or one-sixth of the story propounded by the plaintiffs, which was in the page-and-a-half Cockburn treatment, was enough to instigate the movie and lead to credit of based upon, a fortiori, something five times more than that, is enough to constitute infringement of the right to make derivative work. Now, the issue is, someone may say there's a lot of differences. Well, then we look to that in the allocation of damages. That's what handled that issue. And the importance of that outline of the basic sequence of events is extremely important. There's a Frank Music case on the Kismet review done in Las Vegas, and there the court at the appellate level reversed the finding of 25% attributable to the basic concept sequence of events and said it should be 75%. In the a case which I regret we didn't cite, but the Rear Window case, Aben, which Mr. Petrich is very familiar with, there they said there was 20% perhaps of the basic sequence that was used in the movie, and that was enough. And this is what I think we were precluded from showing in discovery, is to say how that process came about, that they evaluated in their expertise, as their own experts, they came up with the point of what was based upon. And if you look at the page and a half summary by the district court of that treatment by the Cockburns, you don't even have the DeVoe character in there. You don't even have them going to the UN. You don't have them going to New York. All you have is the basic idea that smuggling weapons out of the Soviet Union, falling in the hands of terrorists in Eastern Europe, has created a lot of problems. And if we would have had a discovery, and I would proffer this, Your Honor, in good faith, it's not in the record, but if there had been discovery, perhaps, I'll say hypothetically, maybe there might be disclosure that that page and a half treatment led within 2 hours of it being faxed to the acceptance of that, to the Cockburns being co-producers. And maybe we would have found out that Mr. Spielberg, hypothetically, was the source of the DeVoe character. I mean, this is a very unusual case. This is a case in which it's not about access. It's not about the opportunity to review. It's not even about reading it, which is what the Bochco case was about, and they considered that was access. This is where there was an admission that they had it, and they actually used it. And to me, this is extremely important in terms of the derivation issue. And I want to save a little bit of my time on that because I think that there's an issue they raised on Arnstein versus Porter, so I think relevant to this case.
Okay. Well, then why don't we hear from Mr. Petrich, then we'll get back to you.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. I am Louis Petrich, appearing for the DreamWorks defendants. I intend to show four things. That the plaintiffs attempt to amend their complaint on appeal to state a claim for copyright infringement based on a 1994 letter comes too late. But even if it were allowed, the judgment would still have to be affirmed. Second, that as a matter of law, the movie The Peacemaker is not substantially similar to any protected expression in any of the eight registered works, or as I said, even in the letter. Third, that the concession of access for purpose of getting a ruling where the works themselves are just compared with one another has no bearing on whether the works are substantially similar in their protected expression. Fourth, that I think Mr. Pizzulli tried to raise the notion that somehow the test for showing that the Section 106.2 right to make a derivative work should have a different standard than substantial similarity he talks about based upon. And let me take that one first.
I'm sorry. I actually have a question about number two, which seems to me to be the pivot of the case as it's come forward to us up until today, this question of substantial similarity. And even filtering out the unprotectable elements, because of the procedural posture of this case, we still have to look at the facts in the light most favorable to the opposing party, to you. And with that standard in mind, I don't understand how we get away without a jury in this case. Why there isn't a jury question about similarity in view of the concession of access?
Your Honor, there have been probably six or eight cases affirmed in this court where access was assumed, and I've been in several of them. Certainly the Litchfield versus Spielberg involving the motion picture. Burkett versus Crichton involving the movie Coma. A case decided,
Well, I understand your point. It can be done.
It can be done. And, in fact, it was, Your Honor, excuse me, it was done in effect, it was done in two cases where access was found as a fact. In fact, copying was determined as a matter of fact. Judge Reimer in the Apple computer case, copying was not challenged. The question is whether what was copied was protected expression, and whether in all of these cases, especially where you have a claim not of piracy where you can show there was something taken in toto, word for word, but non-literal similarity, you always have to ask yourself, when we compare the two works at the level of expression at the level that the plaintiff claims there is a taking, are we talking about ideas? Are we talking about scenes of fare? Are we talking about general plot ideas?
In some respects, that would seem to be the case, but what about some of the details, like the can destroy 10 city blocks and other specific details that are fictional elements? They're very specific, and they appear to be in both works, or one of the works on one side and the Peacemaker on the
other. First of all, we're not told that they're fictional. We're told, and I think they come out of Jim Morris's treatment. And they come out of these, some of them come out of the Soldier of Fortune articles, and those statements are made as matters of fact. They're not made as matters of fictional items. The other problem is we have to also be careful that we aren't aggregating all eight works and comparing them to one, because what they're claiming is that at least at one level, they're claiming that they have a specific arrangement that gives them copyrightability of what otherwise are unprotectable matters. And what they're doing is cherry-picking from the aid and say, well, look, 10 city blocks. The district judge pointed out in three other occasions they talked about other kinds of damage areas. They talked about 50 blocks. They talked about a third of a mile, I think it was. So there really isn't anything about to be made of that. And in any event, it's not expression. For someone, they aren't claiming the dialogue was taken. That's an idea, that a bomb can take out a number of blocks. And what is going on when we talk about things like that?
So it sounds like what you're saying is if they have a claim at all, it's a Disney kind of claim.
That would probably be the best claim they would have, and I'll go to that. I don't think they have that claim either.
I have one sort of question for my own interest only, and that is whether the parties have engaged in any attempt to settle or mediate this dispute, either through our mediation services or otherwise.
We've talked to the mediator of the Ninth Circuit, and we've also, well, the parties haven't, but the attorneys haven't. We've made the same offer that was made by the other defendants who were recently dismissed, waiver of attorney's fees. So the point I'm trying to make is that if you look at them at the level of which the plaintiff claims there has been a taking, what you see is abstractions or ideas or seems a fair. And I know counsel says that the judge should have had an evidentiary hearing on the scenes of fair issue. But let's look at what the scenes of fair were that she found. She found that in a case where you're talking about smuggling nuclear weapons out of a country, that it's a scene of fair that you'll come to a border or to a checkpoint, and that you might have a skirmish at the border or checkpoint. I think that's self-evident. I don't think you need to have an evidentiary hearing. She says that in a case where you are talking about a story, and after all, this is all fact-based, the notion that when the Soviet Union fell apart, there was an adequate security of these nuclear weapons, and there was a great concern that they would be smuggled out of the country. She says that it is a scene of fear that when you smuggle out of Russia, you'll probably run into Iraq or Iran because they're on the border. That was one of the scenes of fear. And, of course, the standard in this circuit for scene of fear is not that it has to happen every time, but simply that it is something that flows naturally from the plot premise. And we have a major concession here by the plaintiff's expert, Mr. Whitmore. He said that in a case where you have a premise that the works were, that both works are about a failed effort to take a nuclear weapon from Russia to the United States, that in his words, from a story premise about a nuclear theft and almost successful terrorist act, quote, the sequence of events is dictated by this premise, end quote. We cite that in our answering brief at page 31, note 41. I think that's probably a little extreme because I don't think every incident is dictated by it. But certainly the kind of incidents that you're going to have, they can be strung in different ways to tell a different story. And here the stories are quite different. Plaintiff's story, whether you go to the letter or whether you go to his eight works, are all about how he goes to Lithuania and takes up with this fellow who's the head of the police force, and they chase some smugglers around, and they find out there's nuclear smuggling going on. Then he comes back to the United States. That's not in our movie at all. And there he gets in trouble with the FBI. He says he was framed, and the FBI put him in prison. That's not in our movie. And then he's sprung, in some versions of the story, he's sprung from prison, and he goes back to Lithuania. And there they chase the smugglers down to Iraq. In our movie, we go to Iran. We stop, the smugglers are stopped around Azerbaijan. And then he, in some versions of his story, they chase the terrorist who's he's described as a world-class terrorist. Ours is a piano teacher who is also a member of the Bosnian parliament. And he smuggles nuclear weapons into the United States. And there's a big dispute about whether the nuclear weapons are even alike. They have so-called backpack weapons that are made for that purpose. In ours, it's a trigger for a nuclear weapon that is carried with a backpack. In theirs, the smuggler has great contact with the Middle East terrorists. He supposedly has dinner with all of the terrorists, and they're named Abu Nidal and Yasser Arafat, etc. And using PLO connections, he gets the missile into backpack device into JFK. In ours, the man is a member of the UN delegation, and he gets it into the airport. In some versions of theirs, the story ends at the airport. There's a fight, and the Green Beret shoots the terrorist in the airport, contrary to instructions from the White House. In ours, the terrorist proceeds to Manhattan, and he's not shot. He shoots himself, he's carrying this nuclear trigger, and it's disarmed by Julia Kelly. So What has happened is in both works and all of the works, you have people using the general building blocks for a story about nuclear weapons and smuggling and terrorism and a threat at the in the U.S. And I should point out, again, by aggregating their works, they've covered a lot of territory. They have potential use of this weapon at the World Trade Center. They talk about blowing up bus stations. They talk about other places in Manhattan. And they talk about the U.N. So they've kind of covered the major points in the major entry into the United States, New York. But ultimately what's protected is at least, I would say, three levels. You have the story level where you're talking about the pattern of the characters, the character relationships, and the essential sequence of events. And this circuit has said many times that when you're looking at the sequence of events, you don't juxtapose them out of order because it's the sequence that is the arrangement that is protectable. And that's what you compare. And they could also, I suppose, try to look at specific scenes like the scene of the confrontation of the smugglers at a checkpoint or a border. But they're quite different. You have to look at the details, because it's the details, not the idea, that's protected. In this case, depending on which of the eight versions you take, they have a confrontation at the border leaving Lithuania. They go west, by the way. We go south. In Lithuania, they have this confrontation at the border where they send two cars ahead. They have two trucks. And they have people who, in one version anyway, it takes 50 pages in Red Bull Rising. And they have people in the woods waiting. And then they have a shootout. And they go in, they kill all the guards, and then they go into the barracks and kill everybody in the barracks. In ours, the bad guy, Kordoff, I guess it's Kordoff, has one truck disguised as a Red Cross truck. He's stopped. The guard becomes suspicious, and he shoots the guard. And then they shoot the other couple of guards that are standing around. They're all done completely different. And as Judge Collins said, it's not very surprising that if you're smuggling weapons out of a country, you're going to cross a border or a checkpoint, and you're probably going to have a confrontation if it's going to be a drama. If you don't have a confrontation, maybe it's a different kind of story. As far as the characters go, the rule in this circuit is quite clear. It's very difficult to claim protection for word picture characters that are described. The most likely situation where characters are protected are either where the character tells the story itself. In a sense, Mr. Idema might be that if what you're focusing on is his problems with the U.S. government and his that kind of thing. Maybe that's the story. But that's not our story. In practice, the only time characters are protected in and of themselves usually is where they have some particular unusual physical presence or garb. They started out, they protected comic book characters, Superman, because he had a cape, and Wonder Woman, and so on. Over time, there have been some who have very distinctive things about them, such as James Bond, because we have a series of works, and if you copy all the accoutrements around him, maybe he's protected. But we don't have anyone like that. Now, as far as the concession of access for sake of argument, as I said earlier, we've got the Litchfield case, the Burkitt case, Cavalier just last year, Koof, another movie case, Morell, a case involving the use of historical work to write a fictional work. All of them assumed, for sake of argument, that there was access. All of them, the court was able to determine whether or not there was any taking of protectable expression. We have several cases where copying is established. Feist, in the U.S. Supreme Court, the telephone directory case. Everybody agreed they copied. They copied it verbatim. So if they had infinite access, why did they have to put on any showing of substantial similarity of protected expression? Because the U.S. Constitution and free speech requirements mean that copyright can, the accommodation between copyright and free expression is inherent in the idea of expression dichotomy. And for that reason, this circuit in Croft and the U.S. Supreme Court in Harper and Row said, you have to make sure, de novo, whether or not we are properly enforcing that line between idea and expression. It can't be done casually. Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, before you close, I want to take you back to the problem of the letter as to whether the district court abused its discretion in not allowing an amendment. As I understand it, Adema was still acting pro se at that time.
He was, Your Honor, but he was acting in concert with co-owners. He had argued that that letter was owned jointly by him and the three other plaintiffs who all had counsel. All their papers were filed as a joint filing. Counsel filed the papers, and Mr. Adema also filed them.
If we were to find that we should be more tolerant because Adema was acting pro se and were to send it back to admit the letter, we might be into a situation where the case would have to go forward with discovery and go forward with a trial. It seems to me that there's a bit of need possibly to reconsider mediation and settlement in this case.
Well, we're not opposed to it. It just hasn't happened, Your Honor. But one of the things that I think has to be noted is that this case had a history. Mr. Adema and the other parties were given a year's notice that they had to register whatever they sued on. It's a jurisdictional requirement. Subject matter jurisdiction can't be obtained in a copyright case by a party unless there's registration. It was never pled as a copyright case. They always pled the letter in the third, fourth, fifth, sixth causes as an idea submission case. They did it tactically. We pointed out that in our motions that led up to the summary judgment and the motion to dismiss, they argued to the court that there could be no preemption of their idea submission case under the letter because it was not copyrightable. There's a judicial estoppel there. At least some point, the district judge should be able to rely on what's submitted to the district court.
There's also, counsel, I guess, the issues of whether the state court actions should have been dismissed. There may still be an issue of a breach of confidentiality as to the letter, question of contract that may not be preempted. There are a lot of kind of messy issues floating around here.
Well, I think if you look at the contract case, one thing that stands out is it's only against three parties, and one of them has recently been dismissed, Mr. Peterson. So that leaves you DreamWorks. And there is no allegation that they had a contract with DreamWorks. The letter was sent to to Amblin, which is not a party, and addressed to Mr. Spielberg, who is a party. But there's no allegation that they did satisfy the preconditions for creating a contract with Mr. Spielberg because there was no chance for him to say, I don't want your letter. They just sent it to him, and they tried to impose liability by putting the word confidential on the letter. I think my time is up. I'm sorry I didn't get to the preemption issue. If you have any questions about it, I'd be glad to do it.
All right, thank you, Mr. Baker. Mr. Fusilli?
None of those cases that were cited by counsel where there's evidence or admission of actual copying, which is what we have here. The use of materials sent to Mr. Schiffer, the party admission obtained from him, party admission obtained from Mr. Peterson. And let's also talk about, briefly, the filtration analysis. At any level of abstraction, if you consider going up high and high enough to the level of abstraction, everything or nothing, I should say, is original. It all goes back to Genesis. That's not what we do in these kind of cases. We use a sense of judgment. Let's look at the counterfactual in this case. Let's look at what they described their film to be. And then as we did in our reply brief, we X'd out elements that came from IDEMA. And what did they have left? They did not have enough to constitute the first film for DreamWorks, a message film sent by Mr. Spielberg and Mr. Katzenberg, the author of the famous film about high concept films. This was a high concept film. You have to take it in context. We didn't have the right to do discovery. We would have shown, we believe, Your Honor, the nexus between Mr. Spielberg and his use of the DeVoe IDEMA character that in the connection with this film. But we were not allowed to do that. Now, what's interesting, in their brief, they talk about adopting the Arnstein versus Porter, the Second Circuit case. And it's very interesting, and I would commend court's attention to this. I did not do that in a reply brief, and I apologize for that. But if we look at the Croft case, the Croft case goes into Arnstein versus Porter and purports to follow it. And what's interesting is what they said, that once you get to a finding of actual copying, the issue of whether there has been unlawful appropriation, which is where they say the juncture we're at in terms of evaluating the effect of Sons of Fair, is the proper criterion on that issue is not analysis or the comparison of respective compositions. They go on to say it's not an extrinsic dissection test issue. We are at the stage, with the admissions that we have in this case, of getting to the intrinsic level. And I think that's what Your Honor indicated is, the question is, why isn't this before the jury? We have gotten to that issue with their admissions. They were unrebutted. Unrebutted. This was not a situation. They were not pro se. They had all the access to the best experts in the world, and they couldn't come up with one iota of evidence, not one, that said this was a prior art, this IDEMA story was not novel, and they can't. Because when you do the reverse filtration, and you strip away the IDEMA story elements from their story as they characterize it, they have nothing but a shell left. And let's put it, let's take that just one step further, and I appreciate it, if I have another minute, Your Honor.
Just wrap it up if you can.
Let's assume the Peacemaker came first. And then there was a film based on the IDEMA letter, the IDEMA elements. Are they really going to say with a straight face that they had no claim for an infringement of the second work? And that's really the logical extension here. And that I think, puts the objective test at issue. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, counsel, thank you for your argument. The matter just argued will be submitted. And the court will stand in recess for the day.
This court for the session stands adjourned.